This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do. I am very pleased to introduce to you Lauren Polly, who is described as a catalyst for people who are living their lives on autopilot, and boy, does that fit a lot of people. Lauren is also the author of The Other Side of Bipolar, Revealing Your Strengths to move Beyond the Diagnosis. Lauren Polly, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, now, Lauren, if you're working with people who have their lives on autopilot, I'm grateful that you have time to talk to us today, because I don't know how you're able to fit it in.
It's so fascinating to look at how many of us live our lives that way. And what I mean by autopilot is kind of living your life with eyes shut rather than eyes open. So we end up in these behavior patterns where we constantly react to our environment instead of actually being in create mode and really on the creative edge of living our lives to the fullest.
And again, that is so hard for many people to do, and in a lot of ways not necessarily something that the world in which we are currently living promotes.
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's kind of the interesting thing to look at is people ask me all the time, the clients that I work with, of I don't quite know how I ended up living in this kind of rote, stale pattern and why I feel so unsatisfied with my life when pretty much I have everything that I desire. Like I've got a good family, I've got a good job. From my perspective, a lot of us are massive creators and we really desire to be living a bigger life, having a broader reach and having more of an impact on the world so that when we leave it, it's actually a healthier and a happier place. And I believe we all have a unique capacity and a unique imprint to live on to leave on the world when we leave. And it's interesting to kind of look at. And one of the questions I play with all the time is, where did you buy the point of view that you couldn't actually reach for that? And I think that's kind of the bigger thing that you're talking about is our world and our society really doesn't support that bigger reach. There may be people in your lives, there just might be a point of view from your childhood of you can just go so far. And once you reach that, that's kind of the end game. But then once you reach that, you're kind of like, okay, cool, I've reached all my goals, but now what else? I still have years left to my life. We stop our forward progression and really the evolution of ourselves that way.
You know, what's interesting, Lauren, is that right now, as we speak today, you sound very positive, you have lots of energy, and it sounds like you just have a creative spirit almost itching to share with other people. But life wasn't always like that for you.
Absolutely not.
Let's talk about what life was like for you during early childhood. Where did you live? How were you feeling? What were the people, places, and things that impacted on Lauren as a little one?
As a little one, I had a very creative and playful family. So kind of my early childhood was very imaginative, very playful. I used to sit in the yard and write poetry about nature. It's just kind of more of a creative stance. I was always a dancer growing up. There was a lot of creative mobility in my world and different outlets that I had to express myself. And it was something that my parents really fostered in me, which I absolutely am totally grateful for. And all of that was really smooth sailing until I hit adolescence. And I don't think it's unique to my situation. When I look at the world at large, there's this change point that happens when we're young, we're creative, we're free to explore. And then there's this period, you know, beginning of adolescence, middle school for me, when it hit, of where it was like, it went from being fun and exploratory into having to fit in. And then that led me down the path of trying to figure out how I fit into this world. And being a creative person, a lot of times that isn't an easeful thing. And then if you add sensitivities on top of it, being very in tune to your environment, what other people think of you, what they think of themselves. It's kind of this really slippery slope. And that's when I really started having mental and emotional problems at that stage.
And in fact, by the age of 14, you were in a great deal of pain.
Yes. It started kind of more 13 was kind of the downward spiral. And then 14 was when I was diagnosed with bipolar. And that was after I had actually attempted suicide. So at that point, I had been struggling for maybe 6 months to a year. Again, really having a lot of social issues, not really figuring out how I could fit into the social people at school. There was a little bit of bullying going on. And it was just interesting to me where you have these greater insights into the world. And, you know, I would love the audience just to kind of acknowledge how much insight they have. I think we just think that we see things on the surface. Really, when you're interacting with people, we're aware of a depth of their world and our world, and that doesn't necessarily match what's on the surface. So when someone's talking to you and they're smiling, yet you can perceive their inner pain or their anger or their dislike of you, there's this weird mismatch that goes on. And I was extremely aware of that as a adolescent and a little one, still am. And that was really kind of that struggle that I had of, like, I got so confused. I wasn't sure socially where to go and how to fit in. Do I kind of talk to what's on the surface? Do I address what's deeper underneath? And more of that just kind of built up, and I shut down inside of myself. And eventually it just got so loud and painful, and I felt so lost that I was contemplating suicide. Just to, like, kind of was the only way I could think of to make a change at that time.
Is, you know, for many people, although we know much more about child and adolescent behavior and experiences and drivers, much more than we did, you know, a few years back. But still, for many people, the idea that a child, an adolescent, could be so distraught that ending their life seemed to be the only option, that's still very hard for many people to understand.
Yeah. I remember having a conversation with my ballet teacher a couple years later, just kind of talking about what I had been through in my younger years. And at that point, the conversation, I was still dealing with mental illness and the medications that the doctors had put me on. And she just kind of looked at me. She said, "It's just so surprising. You're so young. You have no idea what lies before you." And I, on a cognitive sense, I could get that even when I was in the midst of this struggle. But at the same time, especially being that age, you're not really looking at the long game. You're looking at, I got to wake up tomorrow and go back to that school. I've got to go interact with those same people where I don't really understand how I fit in or what I'm supposed to do. The perception really of the world becomes so narrowly focused that all you can really see is that glaring problem in front of you. And I think that's kind of a broader way on how we look at life in general. When we have something that's not working the way we desire, it becomes this huge, huge thing in our world where we can't actually gain a broader perspective. And that's really what's missing at this point, at least for me in my life when I was going through all that. And I think a huge thing with adolescents too, you don't see the broader perspective. You kind of see just what's right in front of you.
And I think that's really important for folks to really grab hold of, because you're right. For someone to say to you at 14, you have no idea potentially about the wonders that lie ahead of you, and you're worried about tomorrow or tonight. No, you don't have an idea, because that doesn't exist for you. What exists
exactly
for you is tomorrow and tonight. And if it feels like there's no way out and it's just too painful, then you will do things to harm yourself. Now, you're saying that it was 14, you had attempted suicide, which is traumatic for you and for the family in and of itself, and then you get this diagnosis. Did you have any idea what bipolar disorder meant?
Oh, I had no idea. And it's so funny, in the book, I write the scene where I got the diagnosis, and I didn't understand what the word was. I didn't understand really the majority of what was going on. This was after like 4 hours of psychological testing and meeting with multiple different doctors. The only thing I remember is my mother breaking down into tears and this look of doom on my father's face and the seriousness of which the doctor was speaking. And at that point, I just kind of checked out. I was like, oh, wow, I don't know what I've gotten myself into, but whatever it is, it's not good. And that's the kind of interesting thing, looking at broader topics of like a diagnosis and what it does, the whole conversation at that point turned to the limitations of myself and what I could expect in my future. There really wasn't that dreamer, playful possibility that I had in my younger years and what I was really fostered in my family. It was much more like, oh, you got to look out for these red flags. All these things are coming down the pike. Before I know it, knew it, I had a box of kind of personality traits, characteristics, and also future predictions on what would come down the road just based off my label. And that was a tough pill to swallow, and one that really kind of played itself out in the following months after the diagnosis, the more information I was able to gain from it. I actually went to the library and looked it up, and it was, again, that kind of strange thing of like not knowing, just knowing it was a bad thing at first, and then in the following months getting more information and being like, wow, already at 14, I can flash forward to my future, and it's not something I would actually desire. You know,
what were some of the predictions that you and your family were given once the diagnosis was made?
Oh, well, that medication was needed for the rest of my life, and that even with medication, I could still cycle. It was very hard to control. I was told not to challenge myself too much because stress would be a massive trigger for me. So right away, kind of pulled back. You know, I was a dancer at a very, very high-end program. I was excelling at school. That kind of hidden message of don't go too big, because if you do, you may not be able to handle that level of challenge in your life. It was just kind of this really, not only a small scale, like, the next couple of days, just kind of medication. It's kind of this longer thing of my life of, okay, well, if it's a hereditary thing, you're going to pass it on to your children. And if the shoe can drop at any moment, my brain as a 14-year-old went to, I don't know who would ever want to marry me. Like, who would desire to choose to have me in their life because of all the stuff the doctor is saying, which is a really hard thing for a 14-year-old to go through. And I don't think there's so many labels being given to young ones these days. I don't think we look at that broader perspective and what these kind of forewarnings and red flags that we're putting into their world are creating in terms of their self-esteem and their self-development in the long run. It really created huge hurdles for me that I had to overcome later in my life.
Well, you know, it's interesting because some of the things that brought you the most joy in that moment, mm-hmm. they were taken away from you. You don't want to do too well in school. You don't want to really dance. You don't want to really stress yourself. But those were things that brought you joy. And now they were attached to doom and gloom, it sounds like.
And it's interesting, too. And if, you know, again, going to that broader perspective, if you are a very creative being and you desire not to live on autopilot, but to live full out, there is this constant push and kind of, you know, challenge for greater so that you continue to evolve and develop. That is innate to me. That is actually who I am. So to be told that that was the one thing not to do, because if it did, it would lead down this horrible path, really sent me into a tailspin. I was like, okay, well, then there was this massive shutdown that started to occur, which then took years to start to unlock. And that's the beautiful thing with the book and kind of the later years of my story is meeting different people along the way who actually empowered me to start unlocking that lie of not to challenge and not to utilize my natural gifts. And that's kind of something that I work with a lot of people who are dealing with the mental anguish at this point. If you have a lot of creative energy and you're not actually utilizing it for creation, all that energy is still there. It's just now turned inward. So you end up either spinning or you end up in this massive lockdown. So it's a very different perspective, actually stepping out and utilizing your gifts and not backing away or becoming fearful of them.
I'm wondering, speaking of fearful, I'm wondering how your parents, if your parents told the instructors at school, and did they tell your teachers that you now had this diagnosis?
Yes. I got diagnosed when I was in the eighth grade. And at that point, it was deemed by my parents and the doctors that I needed more. They had initially taken me to a mental institution. The doctors thought that would be the best bet to watch me over 24 hours, make sure that I wasn't cycling, kind of make sure that my medications were stable. Well, my parents drove me there, and the whole environment freaked all of us out. The screaming, the crying. They wouldn't tell my parents when they could come pick me up. They couldn't give them a deadline on, like, okay, she's only going to be here for a couple of weeks. My parents really listened to their inner knowing and this kind of gut thing that they had of, this isn't the best choice to make at this time, which I'm very, very grateful for. So we ended up not going that route with institutionalized. I instead was brought home and taken out of school early in my eighth grade years for intensive outpatient therapy. And then when I started ninth grade, they had set up a special schedule for me. So I did a half day for the first semester of school just to get my feet wet again, and then gradually worked me up to full day by the second semester. It was wonderful. My parents really went to bat with the school system and were able to create an environment outside of the box, really, that served me well and allowed me to continue to go with my schoolwork, but also have that time and that space to really foster myself so that I was in a kind of more stable stance to be able to move forward into adolescence.
But it's also interesting that at eighth grade, the recommendation was that you be a hospitalized inpatient.
I mean,
that's really kind of interesting. So completely pulling you out of your life. And even as you were slowly reintroduced to your life, you and I both know that anytime there's anything different, particularly with children in junior high and high school, oh my goodness, you become the center of attention and not necessarily positive attention.
Oh, exactly. And that was the interesting thing, going to the pool that summer. I was on the swim team, and you could tell everyone kind of had a question of, like, we know you left school a month early. No one really knew why at that time, like my social group anyway, my peers. And then going back into the ninth grade year as well, there were, there were kind of different rumors going around that I was, like, pregnant, or I had cancer, or this thing over here. It's just kind of the thing that adolescents do. There has to be some story as to why she's no longer in class. That wasn't terrible to navigate, I guess I would say. And people were curious as to why I got to leave half day and not stay the entire day like they had to. But I just kind of made up an excuse of, oh, I'm just getting medical treatment. And I would just say it real quick like that and then move on. But it did create this kind of,
Of course. Oh,
she's different.
Yeah.
You know?
Which, again, is the last thing you want to be, certainly not in that way during those years. And you were given any number of medications to take.
Yeah, my highest dosage was when I was like 17. I was swallowing about 14 different pills a day. And this, again, was back in the 90s. There's still, I think, a heavy reliance on medication, but at least now there's more of a talk of kind of like treating the entire individual, which is my perspective, really developing more life-affirming aspects. And when you can do that, you actually don't need as much medication. Or in my case, eventually at age 30, a psychiatrist took me off medication because I was doing so well. But it was just kind of an interesting thing at that time, and what was done at psychiatry, it was like one medication after the other. And I would get a side effect from one medicine, and their recommendation wasn't to back the medication off to relieve the side effect. It was to add another drug in to combat the side effect. So that's how I ended up on so many. I was taking one thing for mood stabilization that caused cystic acne. So then I had acne medication, which caused my body to tremor. So then I had a medication over here to take away the tremors so I could actually go to ballet class. So it's almost like this domino effect. Once you start messing with someone's chemistry, trying to find that sweet spot where they don't have side effects, but they also have enough in their system to do what the psychiatrists want to do, which is kind of like stabilize you, you know?
And you know, for many people, that's the same approach, even as we speak, that you take a medication and then you take the medication for the side effect. Lauren, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like for you to tell us about the psychiatrist who you described as the mousy lady with the badly dyed hair.
Okay.
Folks, we shall return in just a minute. All right, Lauren, therapist, mousy, badly dyed hair, and yet another suicide contract. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, so right after my, basically how my parents found out about my struggles, I was very, very adept at hiding it. There was a high level of embarrassment and shame. And this, for parents, I think listening is huge. I did not want to bother my parents with what I was going through. My parents are lovely. They're very, very supportive. We had a very open relationship. But for some reason, there was something inside me where I didn't want to hurt them. I had kind of put myself in a protector role. So I would come home from school, I'd smack a smile on my face, and meanwhile, all my inner angst I would just shove way down. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wrote the book that I, the way I did, being very, very visceral and revealing so much of the inner angst that we have or mental illness is this inner world where you really don't know what's going on with a person. I think in general, seeing someone walking down the street, we don't really know what's going on beneath the surface, but especially with these bigger issues. So I was very adept at hiding it. How it was discovered is that my parents found a suicide letter that I had written. At that point, I was taken to my pastor's wife, who was a social worker. Lovely, lovely, lovely woman. She's not the mouse I'm talking about. She was the first one to kind of talk to me. And at the end of our conversation, I was introduced to a suicide contract, which is basically a piece of paper saying that I pledge basically not to try to kill myself from this point going forward. And that one felt easy enough to do. You know, I signed the contract. I was very, very relieved because it gave me the awareness in my own world of I didn't really want to die. I just wanted my life to be different. And I had no idea how to create that change at that point. And so it was easy to sign that contract and have that conversation. From there, her recommendation was to go to a psychiatrist, who is the mousy lady with the badly dyed hair you're referring to. And again, second meeting, guess what? A second suicide contract came out. And it just kind of struck me as funny. It was like, okay, well, me signing my name to this piece of paper somehow gives people this like relief in their world that I'm not going to try anything. You know, I could see the relief in my parents' face. It just kind of gave them a little bit more of this. Okay, she actually doesn't want to leave. She's not going to try anything.
And when you signed it that second time, did you intend to honor it, or was it just to sign it to sign it?
I think the second time was much more like, oh my God, here's another one. Like, I didn't quite get why it seemed like such a big deal to people. I had had the awareness from the first signature with the social worker, the one that I knew personally, of like, oh, I actually don't want to die. And at that point, it was such a relief to be able to open up, spill it out, have conversations with my parents. Again, they were very supportive, and kind of like let the floodgates open so everything that I was holding inside could come out finally. And that was really the awareness that I had deep down of like, the killing myself wasn't really something that I desired. I didn't want the end result, which was for me to actually be dead. It was much more seeking a change. And I think that's so important. You know, we just passed actual World Suicide Prevention Day. It was actually last week. And I think either an adolescent struggling with this or an adult, asking really the question to yourself, are you actually desiring to die and not be here anymore, or are you really seeking a massive change in your life that you don't really have the tools or the perspective of how to create? And that to me was this kind of path of signing those contracts. I got aware of myself of, wow, I don't want to be dead. I actually just want my life to be super different. And with these conversations, there was almost this carrot of, well, if we can figure out what's wrong with you and then try to fix it in some way, then there was a little glimmer of hope at that time.
That your life actually could be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was interesting. Like, throughout the journey, the initial life could be different was me going, there's something wrong with me, diagnose me, give me a medication to fix it, and we'll move forward. And then what I had discovered in those later years, gaining more information about bipolar and the diagnosis, is that it was a lifelong sentence, or so the doctors had told me. So that was a very different perspective. Later on in life, it was much more the hope and creating change through developing all aspects of myself and really, again, turning towards my gifts and utilizing them in a generative way, as opposed to that fear thing that we talked about before, where I was like, you can't actually challenge yourself and go for a bigger life. You have to shut down in order to survive.
You know, one of the things that you just spoke about that I'd really like to underscore is the value and the power of your parents being opening mm-hmm. to hearing what you had to say, not discounting it, not trying to necessarily change your mind, but to really allowing you to say the fullness of what you needed to say. That's often very hard for parents to do, particularly if they have a sense that their child is in pain.
Yeah. And it was hard from my end, and still is to this day, having the conversation, because I can see where they're judging themselves. And I think this is huge. If you have a child who is struggling like this, who has been diagnosed, it's very easy from the parent's perspective to make themselves wrong. Like, oh, I failed my child. I didn't catch the warning signs fast enough, or I didn't develop them in the right way, and that's why this thing is breaking down now. It's a very tricky conversation. These diagnoses don't happen to the individual. They happen to the entire family and to everyone really involved in the person's life, even as an adult. The people who are closest to you have a relationship not only with you, but sometimes through the diagnosis becomes kind of this filter and almost third party in the dynamics in of themselves, which is a whole different conversation to dig into. But they were absolutely wonderful, where even through that self-judgment that they had of themselves and almost that fear of like, oh, I need to protect my child, they were still willing to give me what I required and not make it about them, but make it about me so that I could then continue to move forward.
Which, again, is just hugely powerful and hugely yes. important. And I have to thank you for making the comment that the diagnosis doesn't just happen to the one. It happens to the family. I mean, it happens to the entire circle of that individual. So, and again, I think that's something that very often we may overlook. Let's look at where we are. At the age of 17, you were taking about 15 pills a day. At the age of 30, you were taking no pills a day?
Yeah, I had a... Over the years of me going to college and changing psychiatrists, like the first step was me going away to school at 18, and the psychiatrist at my school looked at my medication list and he looked at my body weight. I was a dancer. I weighed like 111 pounds. He said, with the amount of drugs that you're on right now, you should be lying in bed drooling all day. He says, I have no idea how you got into college and then have been able to dance on top of that. He cut most of my medications in half over the next just couple of months. He said, way, way, way too much medication. With that, a beautiful thing happened where the fog that I was living in started to lift. A lot of the side effects started to go away. And I actually started to kind of feel present in my life again, because these drugs cause such a mind fog that you end up sleepwalking really through it. Mm. And then over the years that followed, meeting one psychiatrist after the other, all with beautiful different tools and techniques, the weaning process just continued, basically. When I was 20, I had the massive fortune to move to Florida. And again, that offered another opportunity to find a new doctor. I was flipping through the phone book and the word holistic psychiatry popped off the page. And back in the day, you know, this was in 2000, the word holistic wasn't as big of a buzzword as it is now. I didn't really know what it meant. All I knew is that was what I needed. I followed my awareness with that. He was the first doctor to not only manage the medication, but do hour-long treatment sessions with me with personality development, educational testing, picking a career where I could utilize my gift. He worked with yoga, energy balancing, diet, exercise, stress management, he was one of the main guys who actually weaned me off the most medications, because as he gave me more tools to utilize moment to moment to manage stress and, you know, daily stuff, also to develop more life-affirming aspects of myself, I didn't require as much medication. So that was a massive learning point for me of like, wow, if I actually step up in my own life and utilize all these different tools that I have at my disposal, this really isn't the one thing that will keep me here. It's more my choice in how I live.
And so in his holistic approach, it really gave you a much broader view of your today's as well as your tomorrow's.
Yeah. He was the first one to really light hope in a real way, where when I was younger, the hope came from something's wrong, you know what it is, fix it. His was like, nothing is like quote unquote wrong. There's stuff that you can kind of manage and, you know, work with in a more expansive way, but also like, take your eyes off that one big thing in front of you, that diagnosis, broaden your perspective. How do you actually want to live your life? And, you know, age 20, I was like, I've been sitting on the psychiatrist's sofa for 6 years and no one's ever asked me that before. So to be able to actually then dig into it was, I can't even tell you what a relief and kind of that just warmth that we get inside, where it's like, oh my goodness, there might be something else possible here that I haven't considered before.
And there's somebody who really wants to know and has the sense that there could be something else inside of me beyond the label that sort of sits in front of me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing a lot of interviews about this topic, and someone had mentioned where we are now in society is really in this kind of like demonizing of the medical system or of psychiatry. And yes, I think there may be a place where they've earned that reputation with over medication and the diagnoses. There are also a lot of doctors out there that are employing more of a holistic perspective. I would say if you are under the care of someone right now, ask them more questions about these kind of things. There's tons of different tools and techniques out there. And if you do find yourself on a doctor's sofa where they're not open to looking at different perspectives, I would say there are plenty of other doctors who are. Maybe start, you know, putting some feelers out to see if there's another doctor who may work with you in this way. I mean, it changed everything for me.
Now, before you met that doctor, can I assume that you were dating?
Yeah, I was dating.
And would you tell people?
At that point, when I was 20, I was living in Florida. I had actually gone on a Disney program internship. I was in they have an internship program at Walt Disney World that I was a part of. And I had met a boyfriend at that time, which is why I decided to stay down there and switch my schooling to Florida. So I'd been living with Mark for about maybe 6 months before I met that doctor. And it was wonderful being able to kind of like go through that young relationship where we get into interesting relationships, I think, in 20-year-olds anyway. Kind of more that codependency weirdness that starts to creep in. And then adding the label and the diagnosis on top of it just created an extra kind of tether or you make me safe vibe, which is really hard to actually have yourself in a relationship. I think most people, diagnosed or not, we have a tendency to lose ourselves to the other person or to the relationship unit. We end up giving a sense of our individuality and what that can actually contribute to it. With the diagnosis and the young age on top of it, I just kind of went full barrel into that and really got swallowed up for a little bit.
It's interesting, though, that you did, however, tell your partner that you had this diagnosis.
Oh, yeah. It was always kind of like a big conversation, which is funny now, like writing the book and having it out and about. It just kind of becomes like a misnomer of like, oh, wow, this was a label that I lived with for a long time. Back then, there was so much stigma, not just in society, that's still very much at play, but there was a stigma that I had in of myself. It was like a big, massive secret. So it was always kind of a, when is the time to reveal it to my new friend or my new relationship partner or my boyfriend? And, you know, I did have that conversation with him. He was more than okay with it. And then it was interesting. My dad had a father-to-son chat with him when we were living together and talking about getting engaged. And my dad, being the wonderful provider that he is, more than anything, that conversation wasn't really about providing for me financially or emotionally, that sort of thing. It was much more, she needs special care because she has this diagnosis. Are you willing to provide that? So it was kind of a strange thing where that whole father to son chat really revolved around, she has psychiatrists, she has to take her medication. Are you willing to be there and to support her through that process? Which to me was just kind of odd, I guess I would say. And again, that goes back to how that filter is there, right?
You know, we've been talking about this diagnosis, and it occurs to me that there are people listening who have heard the diagnosis, but don't have a sense of what it actually means or is supposed to mean behaviorally. So let's just take a step back for a moment and tell us what bipolar, how it was described to you in terms of behaviors. What could you look forward to according to the experts?
So bipolar is when you have basically the polar opposites. So we all heard about clinical depression, which are kind of those down states. They're kind of a lack of enthusiasm, a lack of interest. People tend to get a little bit more withdrawn, low energy. And then so with the bipolar, you have that state, which is the low end, I guess they would say. And then you mood fluctuate or you swing from that state into a mania state. And the mania state is feelings of euphoria, rapid speech, being promiscuous, being very impulsive, and highly creative, and which is the interesting thing because, again, that is a capacity that you can develop and actually utilize. And that's pretty much what my book goes into, is actually how to find the strengths that are within this diagnosis in of itself and utilize in a generative way. But the bipolar is that swinging back and forth. So the mood fluctuations were kind of the primary concerns, I guess I would say, from the doctor's perspective.
You know, it's interesting to hear you speak not to the worries or the fears of the diagnosis, although they certainly need to be acknowledged and attended to, but to the strengths. You know, what are the things that as a result of this diagnosis that you now have, assuming it's correct, what are the things that are really yours that strengthen you? Because not the whole experience is necessarily a bad experience. And for you, creativity was always a part of your life.
And that's the interesting thing. I mean, even if you look through history, a lot of the amazing innovators and creators had a mental diagnosis or were kind of thought of as really wacky in general because they saw the world differently and interacted with it in a different way. And to me, a lot of the, like, you know, the subtitle for my book is Revealing Your Strengths to Move Beyond the Diagnosis. It's twofold. It's basically how someone can have the inner strength, pull themselves up by the bootstraps, if you will, to be able to move through this entire process, which is a process. I don't want to diminish that for those of you going through it right now, but also to find the actual gifts, the strengths that you have in of yourself that may have been mislabeled or misused by you because you didn't know any different. For me, being highly creative, there's a lot of energy. If I'm not utilizing that energy in a creative way, it can turn inward on myself and either make me spin in anxiety or kind of create a more stagnant energy, which for me always kind of felt more like that depression that they describe, the black hole energy. Also, I'm extremely, extremely sensitive and intuitive with people around me, which my medical background is as a speech pathologist. I deal a lot with end-of-life care. That actually serves me incredibly well because I'm able to connect with my patients on a deeper level, and I'm able to look into their world in such a way where I can lead them through these processes and this really trying time, probably in a more in-depth and caring way than people who don't have that capacity. In my younger years, I had that, and it kind of went down into much more of a, you know, crazy town path, I would say, because I was super empathetic. I would dive into someone's problems, take it on, and then I would be buried in it. Through developing, okay, cool, I have these sensitivities, I'm able to really connect with someone on a deeper level, I don't have to buy that as mine or dig into their world and carry their sadness, but I can meet them there. And then having my own strengths, gift it? And, you know, could we actually walk that path together to move beyond it? And again, that's a capacity that's actually twisted a lot in our world to look like a weakness. And that's what this book really dives into, is you start to see me in my early years having something go on of like, oh, that's a problem. It's leading down this bad path, to later going, wait a second, that actually may be a strength. And how do I utilize that in real time, professionally, personally, you know, relationship-wise, to actually create a bigger life for myself? So I start to feel satisfied and wake up again.
Which is so incredibly important. Lauren, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk more about what you're doing today and what your life is like today. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Don't go away. Tell us what's going on in your world today. What's life like now?
Oh, life is wonderful. it's so different, and it's such a gift to have these kind of conversations and to even write this book, where I did start it at age 14 and revisit all of those years in such a way where it gave me the awareness of how far I've come. And also with the work that I do now with people who are kind of in the midst of this mental, emotional anguish, to be able to have a sense of what it was like, you know, and keep that fresh in my mind, but also to know that as you walk that path, you will continue to put one foot in front of the other. And for so long, it was just about the one foot in front of the other in terms of maintenance, moving forward, surviving it, that kind of energy, into now where it's actually like, can you utilize that to springboard into greater possibilities and actually have a life that you love? And there are so many people who are living on maintenance at this point. I am really enjoying the stage of my life where it's not about maintenance anymore. It's more about the creation, the enjoyment, and having a bigger reach into the world.
The work that you do with others, give me an example of someone who came to you seeking assistance and certainly not identifying information, but what was going on for them and how did their lives begin to evolve?
I'm working with someone right now who spent 3 weeks hospitalized for a mental illness. And our beginning work together, and I work with tools from a system called Access Consciousness, and they are basically energetic tools, but super, super practical. So it's how to be present in your life, and as things come up, an upset, an anguish, whatever it is, to have enough space in the moment to choose action and not reaction. And what happens so frequently is we're ingrained with these reactionary patterns where we don't have kind of control or creative control of our life. We just end up kind of getting pushed around by our environment all the time. For this woman coming out of the hospital, there's so much trauma involved in, oh goodness, straitjackets and being held down and injected with medications, that sort of thing. A lot of our work at the beginning was kind of releasing the trauma of those experiences through energetic body work that I provide, and then also through these tools to, again, create more space so those reactionary patterns aren't the first thing triggered. Kind of like a PTSD, you know, someone who's got post-traumatic stress, before you have a second to actually go, okay, someone's coming at me in anger. How could I respond to this in a way that actually creates more possibility what are my choices here? Instead, we get activated like a little flip that gets switched, and before you know it, you're yelling. And does that actually create a desirable effect? So the work that I do is much more creating those choice points and getting more space so that you have a chance to ask a question, peruse your possibilities, and then choose in the path of greater possibilities. So with her, it was much more coming out of those trauma reactionary patterns. And now it's about finding not only her feet in her world, you know, getting some stability and that comfortable feeling, which right now is really hard if you're in the midst of it, but also you have a lot of creative energy. She's an amazing creator. She's got a lot of potential. How do you actually start to utilize it? And I think whether you're dealing with a huge mental illness, she's kind of an extreme example. I work with people who have anxiety issues, depression, or just aren't feeling satisfied with their life. If you kind of have that base or maintenance stage, that's great. Now it's about actually looking at the choices you have available and utilizing what gifts you have in your creative capacities to start going in the path that's actually unique for you. So instead of kind of creating yourself in a form, I guess I would say, or how other people want you to be, you know, I'm going to be sane now and behave this way so you feel comfortable with me, or I'm going to be a good mother and create my life this way, or a good spouse, you actually start to create more spaces in your life where there's more choices you have available.
That you can make for yourself.
Yeah, and that's the thing is a lot of people, we don't choose for ourselves. We choose because mom and dad want me to have this career, or my spouse really needs me at home and doing it this way, or my child depends on me for this thing. So our choices after a while start to seem really limited. Like there's only one or two options for moving forward. The way I work is really, again, inviting more space and questions so that you're not just reacting to those expectations others have of you or society has of you, but actually tapping into yourself and what you would like to then create in a bigger way so that when, you know, you're 85 years old looking back at your life, you're like, wow, I actually enjoyed it.
I actually did the things I wanted to do.
I just lived for years and years in one rote pattern, you know?
and you don't have to do that. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, for many people who have the diagnosis or have heard the word bipolar, there are challenges that they have even above and beyond what you describe. There may be visions, there may be delusions, hallucinations. I mean, there are so many other experiences that could be a part of that diagnosis that can actually be very scary to the individual. Yes. Did you have any of those experiences?
Yes, I absolutely did. And I work with that dynamically from a very, very different perspective. Again, what's right about you that you're not getting? And to me, being very, very open, I actually have an ability to communicate with the spirit world. And this is something for me sounds out there. I get it, depending on the audience and your background. But a lot of times when you are perceiving things in the world, you're hearing voices, you may be seeing things, you may be scaring yourself. The question to really ask is, what are you aware of here? Are you aware of people around you who have points of view, who are suffering, and you're diving into their world? Is there maybe, you know, the spirit world conversation is something very different. Is there maybe a spirit around you who is trying to communicate with you? There are different capacities and opennesses that we have that, again, look kind of outside of the box or weird if you're looking at it from this society's perspective. But if you actually broaden your perspective to what might be there as a gift or a capacity, and you can take the fear factor away, that's a totally different playing ground. So I kind of play with it with both angles. And what I had experienced for myself, a lot of those kind of hallucinations, those scary visions, was my awareness of people in my world that were going through stuff that I was picking up on, psychic abilities, if you would, or being empathetic or really tuned into your environment. And then also, what's behind your vision? Your actual seeing eyes, is there a greater thing at play that you're then tapping into?
So for you, they again became less scary and a point, it sounds like, of curiosity, of detective work, if you will, to understand why you were experiencing it, what the experience was, and what kind of meaning it had for you.
Well, and I absolutely love what you just said. I've never heard someone put it that way, but it's brilliant, the detective work. And for me, that innate curiosity, it takes us back to childhood where we were actually open and exploring the world. And we lose that as adults. We stop exploring. We just take someone else's definition or explanation of what's going on. And so you'll buy into the fear factor. You'll buy into the point of view that it's just this one thing. It's really about stepping back from all of that and looking in for yourself so you can follow your own innate knowing and detective work, curiosity. What's actually going on here? Take away the fear factor and start to really play with what you know, not what other people are telling you.
I wonder, as you were going through the early days of medication and therapy and psychiatry, were you given medication with the intent to diminish the hallucinations? Did you let people know that you were experiencing them? How did you even think about them then?
They scared me.
Did you tell anyone?
Yeah, when in my early years with a psychiatrist, I had kind of started to share a lot of what was going on with my inner world. And it was fascinating because as soon as I would open my mouth about something, he was very, very quick, the initial guy that I saw, to throw a label at me. And every time that label came in my direction, it just felt like someone was throwing daggers at me. And my result was to put up a wall and shut down. And so after, you know, I have a chapter in the book called It's Not Safe to Share, and that was the exact energy that came up of like, wow, if I actually talk about this stuff that I'm aware of, people are either going to think I'm crazy, they're going to give me a diagnosis, they're going to up my medication, or I'm not going to be safe in some way. This was at a time where I was also starting to share with my peer group of what went on, some of my friends at school, and was met with the same kind of judgment. So again, that shutdown started to occur, which took a little bit, you know, time and years and different tools and different perspectives to really unravel and unlock. But I think at that time it was just, I was scared. I wanted someone to make them go away. So the medication started to do that in of itself with that fog that it came on. It really shut me out of those inner capacities. And then it was just, over the years, step by step by step, meeting different people and using different tools where the fear factor of myself, being fearful of myself, started to change. And then that kind of opened the door for more exploration under the care of doctors and different psychiatrists and psychologists to be able to explore in an open way.
So what I'm hearing, certainly for the clinicians who are listening, is that while the labels may be of a particular use in a particular way, it's not necessarily that you need to, 3 seconds after a client has disclosed something, slap a label on it, and because then it constricts the dialogue.
Yeah, and you know, I work with this kind of from a different perspective as a speech pathologist. I utilize my diagnoses as a way to bill insurance because that's just the way the insurance system works on a practical level.
Right.
And it just gives me information.
Exactly.
And so without a label, without a box, I say, here's information to my patient. How does that feel for you? Does it feel like I'm kind of describing what it is that you feel? Okay, cool. Let's continue to explore that and keep that as a looseness and just information to work with, not as something that you have to continue to create and live by. And what that does, it actually allows me to do, I guess, what you would call diagnostic therapy, where you can continue in a broader perspective and more of that curiosity. You leave it open for yourself as the clinician, but then also your patient gets that same energy. They have that openness, and that fear factor or that lockdown doesn't occur.
Makes great sense. Thank you for expressing that and bringing that to our awareness. I think just as clinicians, there may be times when, particularly in the world of utilization review and insurance and codes and all of that, it can sometimes allow one to forget about the true value of a label, if you will, the true value of a diagnosis. Mm. You don't need somebody to live into the diagnosis.
And you end up creating yourself. So how often do you give a person a diagnosis? Like in my case, I got the diagnosis. I actually started living like that was my truth and my personality. Mm-hmm. I created myself in that vein. And a lot of people will do that. So it's beautiful if you give them information and keep it open, not give them that label and that definition of themselves as that. Because that, you know, you create your reality based on your perception and your perspective. So you'll continue to go that way.
Very true. Lauren, yeah. It really has been a delight to talk with you today. And I'm going to ask you if you would share with the listeners your website or a way to be in touch to learn more about what you're doing.
My website is my name, Lauren Polly, and that's with a P.com. My book, The Other Side of Bipolar, is up on Amazon currently, and it will be in local bookstores at the beginning of October. So you can find it there. And then all the information is on my website, my sessions, my workshops. I do a lot of online long-distance sessions, so no matter where you are in the world, I can connect with you. And I'm just really passionate about allowing people to explore their gifts and their possibilities, and not live into limitation, but to really turn towards the limitless potential that we all have.
Again, I want to say thank you to Lauren Polly. That's LaurenPolly.com, author of The Other Side of Bipolar, Revealing Your Strengths to Move Beyond the Diagnosis. Thank you again, Lauren Polly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you daily on demand by going to the Mind Talk website, which is mindtalk.org, or by downloading the Mind Talk app from iTunes. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is pamela@mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. And folks, I want you to remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.